This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. Today, we're in Valence.
Where are we, Lionel?
We're outside some kind of horrible building in Valence, next to the bins.
Lovely. How poetic.
Very poetic, but also accurate.
Thanks, Lionel, for that. Really setting the scene beautifully. My name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freeb.
Hello.
And somebody else who I'll introduce in a moment, because we've got a special introduction for him, so I don't want to spoil that yet. Lionel, give us the run-through of what happened today's stage.
Stage 15 of the Tour de France, finished in Valence. Big break, went away. Peter Sagan in it again. Amazing.
I mean, phenomenon, isn't he? He's a phenomenon.
A phenomenon when you consider that after they got caught, he then participated in the sprint and finished fourth as well. I mean, that is...
Has anyone tested him for being human?
The other day we said he'd gone backwards.
He'd regressed. Well, he hasn't won three stages this year as he did in 2012. And from that point of view, from a results point of view, he has regressed. But his consistency is remarkable.
Yeah, I was about to say, our consistency has never been our strong point.
Whereas his...
His certainly is. Oh
yeah, but the Tour de France changes every day, doesn't it? The story evolves. A few days ago.
If you don't like my principles, I can get some new ones.
A few days ago, he had a great chance to win a stage, and since then
He's improved at cycling.
Oh, for goodness sake!
Who won?
Andre Greipel, third stage win of the Tour, an all-German shootout. He beat John Degenkolb in the sprint. Impressive stuff from Greipel, and he's still fighting hard for that green jersey, although Peter Sagan is really in the driving seat. In that, no change overall. Chris Froome, well in control.
OK, I mentioned that we had a fourth guest today, which we kind of need to help, because we're sort of half a man down. Daniel's still suffering with the heat, not as usual. Bubbly self.
There's no need to be flippant about it. It's an actual medical condition. It's heat exhaustion.
I know. That's why we've been supporting you, Daniel. Okay. Did I not bring a big bottle of water up to your room last night?
Yeah. Anyway, get on with it.
So we're joined by a fourth member, a familiar guest. But to introduce him, we are going to play a little theme that's been sent in by a listener. Somebody called Alan from the band.
Oh, Richard, thank you very much. You know I'm not a Welsh speaker, so I'm not even going to embarrass myself and get corrected by the pronunciation police on that.
Have a go.
Hang on a minute. It's the band is called, is that E New Y and then a new word, N-I-W-L. Hopefully our Welsh listeners will tweet us at cycling_podcast with the phonetics of how to pronounce that.
Anyway, these are listeners of the podcast. They're professional musicians, accomplished musicians, and they have composed this theme tune for Ciro. Ciro. Ciro, Ciro, Ciro. Ciro, what do you think of your theme tune?
Richard, very good, it's marvellous, but I have to complain with you, because you are my friend, maybe all three of you are my brothers, more or less, but I don't understand why in this podcast we are talking about Greipel, we are talking about Chris Froome, we are talking about Nairo Quintana or the bad tour till now, Vincenzo Nibali, but we are not talking about the real matter, the real problem of this tour. It's so hot. And so my question is, I want to ask you from now, from this our podcast, to Christian Prudhomme, is also a friend of our podcast. Christian, why in this edition so few stages near the sea? This is the problem, my friends.
Never has that been more true, Ciro.
Okay. So you agree with me. So
we do agree with you. Absolutely.
We should organize something with Christian and with the organization in order to change something for next year. I think that also our listener will be happy for that.
We have arranged something with Christian. I think you're seeing him later this week, Daniel. Now, Ciro, we obviously spent a lot of time on last night's podcast, and we will get on with the stage. I've got a couple of interviews in tonight's podcast to play later on, but we spent a lot of time last night talking about what happened with Chris Froome and alleging that a spectator had thrown urine in his face. We learned later that another spectator allegedly spat in Luke Rowe's face. There's a lot of anti-Sky feeling, which Chris Froome has blamed on some irresponsible reporting in the media. In his press conference tonight, there was a bit of a tense, slightly hostile atmosphere. The media, nothing, no entity is as sensitive as the media if they think they're being criticised collectively. I mean, is that a fair comment?
Yeah, I think it probably is a fair comment, but I think the unfortunate thing last night and tonight in the press conference was that Chris Froome came in and before waiting for a question, he kind of launched into his own soliloquy, and I'm not sure that's a terribly good idea, just to kind of, you know, set the... whether he's trying to set the agenda or just being polite and coming in and giving his version of how the stage has gone. But I think, really, the press conference is for the journalist to ask questions. And you know, it's not really for the rider to set the agenda in that way. So I think that maybe partly contributed to the slightly tense atmosphere from the off this evening.
I was going to ask, we'll talk about this a bit more ourselves, but I was going to ask Chiro what his view was as an outsider, as a non-British journalist. What's your view of it? And what is the view, you know, in Italy or elsewhere in Europe?
The problem, in my opinion, is this culture of suspicion, I mean, that is in cycling now, but in my opinion, is not good. And also in the peloton, I worked a lot about this stuff today, and I understood this is a news for our listeners. I will write tomorrow on Gazzetta edition that also between riders there isn't a common view on this topic. In which sense? There were some riders that, in order to protest against these fans, this bad atmosphere against the Sky, there were some riders they would have liked to start the stage of today slow.
Can I interrupt you? And sure. guess who one of the riders who wanted to start slowly was? Was one of them Filippo Pozzato?
I can't say anything about that. Sources, listeners, we have also to be clear on that. Sources are a religion.
Must remain confidential.
Confidential, Richard, you are a real journalist, but we knew that already. And so there were some of them, but no one agreed.
So that's interesting. So there was an attempt to organise a sort of, not a protest, but a little... a gesture almost to ride slow, and we've seen this over the years on various issues, from wearing of helmets to the doping suspicion, which was well founded in 1998. There was a sit down protest at one point. So there was. Do you think this was it just something that the peloton couldn't agree on as a group?
Yes, exactly. This is the doping. I mean, in the Tour now, if I'm not wrong, there are 170 riders left, so it's almost unlikely to think that every one of them is. Agree with the theory, but the fact is that the culture of suspicion is still in the peloton. I mean, I'm not happy with that, but it's the reality.
You mean it's in the peloton, or it's by the public towards the peloton?
In my opinion, in the public, but also in the peloton.
So there are riders and teams suspicious of other riders and teams.
Exactly, they don't say this open-mouthedly. But yes,
openly. Yeah, interestingly. Yes. I mean, Chris Froome was asked whether, you know, what the reaction had been in the peloton, and he said that he'd been overwhelmed by the support that he got in person and on social media. I was quite struck. Alberto Contador tweeted something. One or two riders did. There wasn't an overwhelming tide of sort of support on social media. I mean, we shouldn't maybe judge it entirely by social media. But at the finish, I did speak to one rider, a German rider on the Giant Alpecin team, Simon Geschke. Is that the right pronounce?
Geschke,
apologies. The bearded German rider on Giant Alpecin. I spoke to him because he was one of the riders who did tweet his outraged disgust at what happened, what had allegedly happened on the stage to Mond. So here is Simon Geschke. Simon, you tweeted last night about some of the abuse of the Team Sky riders. Have you witnessed any of that? Have you seen any of that?
Not exactly. I didn't see anyone throwing anything at Chris Froome, but I just felt some kind of, maybe hate is a too strong word, but some aggression against Team Sky, and I really don't understand, because I just heard some people yelling boo at the sign-in to Chris Froome, and It's just very disappointing to see, because I think cycling fans are really having a very good image, and I still think so. It's not like in soccer that there are hooligans or something, but I just hope that it stays like that.
Would you like to see the other riders also come out and speak out against it as well?
Definitely, yeah. If something like that happens to me, I think it's just the most disrespectful thing you can do at a bike race, is throw something at the riders. It starts with people just jumping on the road, taking the risk of causing crashes. It ends with throwing urine at someone. It's just.
Have you seen anything like that before? You know, in your years racing, is it something you've had experience of in the past?
Of course, yes. Yeah, sometimes there are always less intelligent people, and this year in the Giro, it was also that the spectators caused two massive crashes, and I just hope that the people are really. It's hard to control. I mean, you cannot put fences on 200 kilometers of racetrack, but I just hope the people realize the risk they take, and it definitely hurts when you get hit by bikes.
Is there anything the riders can do as a group?
Not much. I saw a really funny tweet today that there are the unwritten rules in the peloton that you, for example, don't attack in the feeding zone or when the yellow jersey stops for a piss. Maybe it's time to have the unwritten rule, if something happens with spectators, that the whole bunch stops and takes revenge.
The other eventful thing that's happened to you, Simon, is you had your shoes stolen one night in the hotel, I read, as well. Did you manage to get your shoes back, or have you got a replacement pair of shoes?
I got a replacement. They are stolen, they are gone. Someone is happy with my old shoes now.
And were they old? Did they smell?
No, they were not old. They were the same like these pairs, but... yeah, they're really not smelling very good, because there are a couple of hard stages before. And
so anyway, they're blue Shimano shoes with yellow soles. If anybody sees them, they can be returned to their rightful owner.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not believing in that anymore. But thanks to Shimano for the replacement, definitely.
Follow us on Twitter @cycling_podcast or on our website, thecyclingpodcast.com.
So we heard there from Simon Geschke. I think we're going to talk about this a little bit longer, because there's not a lot to talk about on the stage, was there, really? It's one of those classic transitional stages. Mark Cavendish was dropped early on. Not a good day to be awarding him a Pedlar de Charme t-shirt, and the opportunity didn't really arise for that, because we couldn't make it to the start, and the finish was a bit away. I was there, but Daniel obviously is recovering, so he'll have to present the... Oh, Giro's running off. Is he going to come back? You'll have to present the Pedlar de Charme t-shirt to them another day, Daniel.
We're always slightly dismissive at this point in the tour of these so-called transitional stages. Today was 46 kilometres an hour for over 2,000 metres of altitude gain. So I think it was pretty brutal in the peloton. And one thing I noticed was, what I've noticed over the last few days is, and I mentioned this on Twitter, how there are a number of riders with big reputations and who had big hopes coming into this tour who have really not had the tour that they wanted and are really... shown a lot of courage in trying to salvage something, trying to redeem themselves or their teams. Roman Bardet, we've seen him breaks a couple of times. Thibaut Pinot, Ryder Heijerdahl is sort of coming to the fore now. And there are others.
Kwiatkowski.
And they really don't, you sense that they don't really have the form to deliver the results that they're looking for. But still, it just shows how much the tour means to people. And all credit to those guys.
Well, maybe now is a good time to introduce our Pedaleur de Charme for the day.
And now, le Pedaleur de Charme, supported by British Eurosport.
So, the British Eurosport Pedaleur de Charme, a few nominations for different people. And Kwiatkowski was a popular nominee. So was Peter Sagan. Daniel?
Yeah, I was just going to nominate. There's absolutely no reason for this nomination at all, but I wanted to shoehorn some kind of mention of this into the podcast somehow. What would BMC doing at the end? Can we give BMC the Pedaleur de Charme jersey en masse for
Pedaleur de Charme helmets?
The most spurious lead out ever seen in a bike race.
And who was it for?
No one knows.
That was bizarre, wasn't it?
Yeah, but they were doing that in the first week to keep TJ safe, weren't they? That was what they did.
TJ Van Garderen.
Yeah, TJ Van Garderen. Maybe that was what they were doing. I mean, there's no other rational reason for the whole
thing. Van Avermaet didn't have much chance. There were a couple of Bora attacks, right? Attacks by the Bora riders who we shared a hotel with last night. They were obviously motivated after sharing a hotel with us.
And a late bid by Zdeněk Stybar.
Zdeněk Stybar.
I got told off on Facebook for pronouncing, making it more syllables than it should be. But it's difficult.
Zdenek.
Just wait till we get that. Just wait till our Welsh audience comments on your pronunciation of that band.
Anyway, go on.
Anyway, yeah, Zdenek, Stibar. Stibar had a go. Tichiro's back tapping away on his computer as he does. He's finishing off that story he was telling us about earlier. It's two Z's and one T, Chiro Pazzato.
Oh dear.
Actually, on that note, we haven't done Pedlar de Charme, and I was about to. Filippo Pozzato has to win Pedlar de Charme one day. He has to, because. We know right, so we're going to fix it.
He's going to get the general classification. He's going to get the last one in Paris.
Are you confident he's going to finish the race?
Chiro and I have got this agreement with him.
Yeah, but when's this going to happen?
Well, in the next couple of days, but he keeps reassuring us that no, because I keep saying, yeah, Filippo, it's okay. Arranging to meet us, you know, on next Thursday, but you're not going to be in the race next Thursday, are you?
Not next Thursday.
Not going to make it over the Pyrenees. And he said, no, I'll make it over the Pyrenees. And so he's very confident. So you don't worry, Richard.
So who is the British Eurosport Pedaleur de Charme today?
Kwiatkowski or Sagan? Well, let's go with a majority decision out of the four of us.
Well, I think Sagan. I mean, yeah, he got in the break. He'd been in the break the previous day, finished fifth, I think, at Mond, you know, today, to actually then mix it in the sprint as well.
Does kicking a TV motorcycle rider not disqualify you from the Pedaleur de Charme?
Well, that's a very good point, yeah. Well.
Kwiatkowski.
I'll go Kwiatkowski. Chiro, Peter Sagan or Kwiatkowski?
Sure for Kwiatkowski, because in the final there was a quarrel between a friend of our podcast, Cocard, and Sagan. And so, if I'm not wrong, Sagan was not fair, really, in the final against Cocard. So, I'm from Kwiatkowski.
Kwiatkowski. Sorry, Peter, about that. He's not, you know, he's... But he's a phenomenal athlete, isn't he? I mean, he'll no doubt be in a breakaway, and he'll probably win an Alpe d'Huez, the way he's going. Anyway, let's crack on. Now, let's talk a little bit more about the unfortunate events, I guess, because we weren't at the start today, but we heard the police presence around the Sky Bus had been upped again today. And we, you know, between the three of us, we had a slight difference of opinion last night about whether it had been a wise move by Chris Froome to come out and blame the irresponsible reporting in the media, because inevitably this was interpreted as he was blaming the media for a cup of urine being thrown at it. That's not what he was doing, and he did try and make that distinction, but I think he made it far too easy for people to say that he was blaming the media.
Yeah, I think in hindsight, once we'd recorded and then you mulling it over a bit more, I think the most obvious thing that leapt out to me was that if you're going to come in and say something like that, you need to be specific about your targets. Who, you know, what are the specific pieces of irresponsible coverage that he feels have incited this reaction? And then I think we move things on. At the moment, we're just stuck in a cycle. We're not going anywhere. Today's press conference was edgy and needly, and, you know, the questions were quite spiky, and Froome was equally spiky, and I can't imagine.
The tone was confrontational, in a way that it was with Lance Armstrong, but Armstrong could handle that, almost relished it, in a way that Chris Froome doesn't and can't.
Well, yeah, I mean, because you wonder, you know, with Froome, if Chris Froome is racing the Tour de France clean, he's having a pretty horrible time. You know, there's not a great deal of joy in his day, other than what he keeps going back to, which is that he's focused on the race. And but it must be taking its toll on not just him, but, you know, the people close to him. And
it's difficult for him. It's fine for us to say to him, be specific on your targets. He can also turn around to the press and say, be specific in your allegations. Allegations based purely on performance are very difficult for him to counter.
Yeah, I think one point perhaps didn't make clearly enough last night is there's a difference between what is the right thing to do and what is the natural thing to do. And I think very often Chris Froome is reacting in a way that's completely understandable and completely natural, but if we judge it dispassionately, it's probably not helping him, and it might be inflaming the situation. But that applies to Team Sky as well as Chris Froome. I mean, Dave Brailsford was almost ambushed tonight on France Television, the host broadcaster. He went on there after the stage. There was a long discussion about wattages. You know, actually, extremely high power numbers were quoted, or watts per kilo numbers, much higher than I've seen elsewhere on the internet. 7 watts per kilo for Froome's ascent of the Pierre Saint-Martin the other day. And there were really some silly questions asked of Brailsford, like, for instance, are you prepared to stop going to Tenerife on training camps? Well, Tenerife has had a bad reputation in the past because of A, it was associated with Michele Ferrari. He did undeniably use Tenerife and El Teide, where Sky go, as a venue for training camps. But also there is a perception, and Chris Froome's pointed this out, and this is actually reality, I think, that for a long time athletes weren't tested there a lot. However,
the whereabouts program didn't even exist at the time.
Yeah, and however, you know, pretty much every top rider at some point in a year nowadays goes to Tenerife because, well, obviously the advantages of the altitude. You can stay there at 2,000 meters, and the weather is very good, and it's including in winter, which is very difficult to find somewhere where you can train at 2,000 meters and the weather is consistent.
And Chris Froome has said this week that when he's been in Tenerife and he's felt he's not been tested enough, he has made that point to the UCI. I mean, you know, that's what I'm saying. We're going round in this loop at the moment, and something has got to break the loop. And I'm personally not sure that a police presence around the bus and these confrontational press conferences with the kind of the general broad stroke non-specifics, I don't think that's going to break the cycle. So what I'm completely... Well, I don't know. I don't know what the answer is, and that's the big difficulty. But you're exactly right, Daniel. The problem is that doing just the thing that makes the race better for Chris Froome and Team Sky, you know, that could also then be interpreted as the wrong thing. You know, trying to steer conversations away. He's met it head on today. He's been quite confrontational about it. You know, that whether that works, we'll see over the coming days. But we've got another five, six days of this, including a rest day press conference. We assume Team Sky will hold one. And I think the atmosphere, it's a bit like with the repeated days of hot weather. You know, we need a nice cooling drizzle.
You were joking earlier, Lionel, that we're going to get a call in the next couple of days telling us that the Team Sky press conferences is at 3 a.m. on Tuesday morning. Giro.
No, 3 a.m. Tuesday morning, Richard, is not good for me. So Sky can't do this, because one of my problem in this tour is that I'm not really able to sleep a lot. You know, Richard, I need 8 hours and a half, 9 hours sleeping every day. This tour, between 6 and 7 hours. So our listeners can imagine really well.
And you're from Napoli. Are you not used to the heat?
Yes, but it's not the problem of the heat. No, I mean, for me, the heat is good. The problem is that I work too much in this Tour de France, Richard. This is my real problem. How can I do? Help me.
Giro, send him some sleeping pills. Giro, something I heard yesterday, is this correct that Vincenzo Nibali had €500 and his Tour-winning sunglasses from last year stolen from his hotel room while he was at breakfast yesterday morning?
Yes, it's true. €500 and also a pair of glasses that he used during the last Tour de France. So maybe it's not the value amount of money, but maybe it was linked to this glass because he used the last year. The main thing for him, if I understand well, is... I mean, he certainly was disappointing for the fact, but mainly because he didn't like the behavior of the owner of the hotel. In a certain way, he said, unfortunately, I don't know the correct expression in English, but Daniel can help me. Nibali said that the owner of the hotel washed his hands about this story. I mean, it's not my fault. It's up to you.
That's a great expression in English. Yeah.
And so... I'm surprised. Is really the correct expression?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, I'm surprised. And so for this reason, Vincenzo was a little bit disappointed, yeah.
Yeah. Is he still a lighthouse, Vincenzo?
For me, no, it's not a question of lighthouse, because it's maybe more a question of a shadow in a certain way. I'm his shadow, and in a certain way, maybe also he could be my shadow. Because the point of a perspective can change, and maybe because we are also used to consider me as the shadow of Vincenzo Nibali. But why Vincenzo Nibali? Also, he could be my shadow. Have you ever thought about this or not? Daniel,
this is getting really weird.
During the Tour de France, listen twice a day to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. There is all the latest interviews and analysis from every stage in the evening show. And in the morning, Monday to Friday, Kilometer Zero will take you inside the tour in the company of the podcast team, Richard Moore, Daniel Freib, and Lionel Burney.
So after that bizarre little digression there from Ciro, and we'll pour over his words later, I think, and we'll just as last night we were analysing, you know, what we'd said, whether we'd put ourselves across properly in the podcast, we'll probably be discussing what Ciro's just said. It was quite deep. I sense there was a lot of meaning in there. Lots of layers to what he just said, and we'll try and fathom it later on, I think.
We can dissect that over a beer, can't we, later, and explain tomorrow.
I think what we should say is that we're not going to talk about the same thing every day. We're going to try and move the conversation on. We're going to try and talk about other things. We want to talk about other riders in the Tour as well and other teams. And there are a few that we want to talk about. Tony Gallopin is one that I tried to speak to today, and he brushed me off. But I'm hoping that I'll catch. Why did you laugh at that, Daniel?
Well, talk us through that. I know his wife brushed you off. You had something set up with her and
Marion Roos. Hang on. That's not entirely okay. True. Marion Roos is on the race.
Wife.
They got married last autumn. Okay. She is on the race working for Eurosport, and I've been trying to fix up an interview with her for a while for a special Kilometer Zero feature, which you'll hear in the coming week. Tony Gallopin, he galloped away. Another day, I'll get him another day. You know, riders finish the stage, a fast stage like that, and they're pretty exhausted. But I did manage to catch up with Robert Hessink, who's another one who's been on our hit list now, the Dutch rider, who I think is 28 now, could be wrong, 28, 29. You know, we all remember him as this great prospect who emerged a few years ago as the next great sort of Dutch stage race rider. They've got great pedigree as climbers, weirdly, for a flat country.
Mainly in recent years, because they've really made a concerted effort to look for climbers. The Rabobank Academy system set out to just find climbers and really neglected sprinters and rouleurs, and you've actually seen the consequence of that in the last few years because they've not produced a decent sprinter for a long time. And yet they have brought on and developed all of these climbers, Hessink, Mollemaar, there have been others, but even Peter Wiening, Theo Elting.
And Wilco Kelderman as well.
Wilco Kelderman, who's not having a very good tour.
But yeah, my Robert Hessink anecdote for this evening. I interviewed him a few years ago in the Netherlands, and I noticed that he had the computer game Pro Cycling Manager on his one of the very few things on his bookcase. He didn't have any books, didn't strike me as a big reader. We got chatting about Pro Cycling Manager because I was quite a fan of the game, quite good at it. I asked him, you know, whether he played it, and he said yes, but he was very frustrated at the time because he would be Rabobank in the game, and he was frustrated that Robert Hessink in the game wasn't very good.
Well, poor old Robert Hessink, he's a very personable guy, and he has had a really awful few years. He has had health problems. He had a heart problem that needed surgery. He broke his leg, I think, in a crash. He lost his father tragically in a bike crash, and he had problems with he's got a couple of children, I think, but his last child was born very prematurely, I believe. I referred to his difficulties in that euphemistic way that you do, and he initially said a lot of the problems he had were private, but then he did actually list them. And, you know, that's a hell of a lot any one of those things is a hell of a lot for somebody to go through. And he has come to this tour, and he's finally sort of delivering on that promise that we thought he had years ago. He's riding extremely well. He rode very well on the first day in the Pyrenees. And he's seventh overall, but he is not riding a la Zabeldia. He's been very visible. He was attacking that day. You get the sense that he's now, as he'll say in the interview, aiming for top 10, which might make a stage win difficult, but you know, you've had the impression that a stage win is what he's been gunning for.
We talked, I think, earlier in the tour about this very long drought for Dutch riders, 26 years without a rider in the yellow jersey, and I was speaking to a few Dutch colleagues early in the race and asking them who should have really done it for them, who was the one guy who's emerged in the last two decades who could have won a tour or should have won the tour, and a couple of them said that Hessink actually had the talent to do it but wasn't mentally strong enough. However, having had all these personal difficulties, that maybe now he's developed the mental strength. Richard Plugger, the Lotto NL Jumbo manager, contradicted that really to me the other day. I asked him about Hessink's mental strength, and he said if there is anyone in this peloton who is stronger mentally than Robert Hessink, I'd be surprised.
Interesting. Well, let's hear from Robert Hessink. He, at the finish in Valence today. You're having a fantastic tour. How does it feel to be performing as you are? Because you've had obviously a lot of difficult years. How does it feel to be riding as well as you are this year?
I'm happy the way it goes. Last few years I had some difficulties, most of them in private and family. But now I'm feeling well, and so far it's a good tour for me. Yeah.
What were your ambitions coming into the race?
I think the same as now. Top 10 is what we said in the start, and I think now it's getting more realistic. Still, of course, it's possible to have a bad day, and you never know how it goes. But so far, I think it's realistic. Yeah.
And what do you put it down to? This, you know, this. You were the great sort of Dutch hope for a while in stage race, in particular. You had problems with your health as well, but it seems to have clicked for you. What's gone right?
Yeah, as you said before, I mean, I've had some difficulties in the past. I lost my dad. He crashed his bike. Then you have to get back from below zero, I guess. Then I broke my leg. Again, had to get back from below zero. Then I had heart surgery. Again, had to go back. Then last winter, we had some really difficulties with my youngest son before he was born. It's all good now, but if you have to come back from below zero a few times, then it's not always possible to perform at your highest level. I need some more luck.
You must be enjoying, though, being here, leading your team, and riding in the top 10 and climbing with the overall favourites in the way that you are.
I became more mature because of all the things that happened. Better at seeing things in perspective, in the right perspective after all that happened. Maybe also it's easier to let it loose after a race if things don't go as planned or something like that. I'm enjoying cycling still and happy to be here.
Top 10 is your goal, but the Dutch Alpe d'Huez is known as the Dutch Mountain. That's the penultimate day. Is that a stage you're particularly looking forward to? There'll be huge support for you on Dutch Corner.
Yeah, that would be the ultimate and the biggest dream. But first, some other bumps and difficult days to take. Yeah.
You are listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar, with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney, and Daniel Frabe.
So that was Robert Hessink there. Good luck to him. Just mentioning the Ala Zubeldia jersey, that is in honour of Haimar Zubeldia, who's riding this tour, the Basque rider who always finishes sort of between 5th and 9th, but rarely with any visibility. You don't even know he's been riding the race, and then you look at the results at the end, and there he is in 7th or 8th. He is riding, but he's not riding Ala Zubeldia this year. He's down in 38th. So who is the new Zubeldia?
Well, that's the unusual thing, isn't it? Because really, the top 9 have all been very visible in this race. And I suppose at the moment, in the Ala Zubeldia jersey, you'd have to say it's Bauke Mollema, ironically, Zubeldia's Trek Factory Racing teammate.
Tony Gallopin as well. I mean, he's 9th, and he's a guy who is certainly capable of winning, as we saw last year. And, you know, you just wondered, see, Nicholas Roach did this for years of trying to finish in the top 10 instead of going for stage wins, and I'm never quite sure if that's a sensible strategy.
Bauke Mollema, I hate to mention this, but he is probably the ugliest rider in terms of pedalling style certainly in the upper echelons.
He looks like Fernando Escartin.
Very like Escartin.
Same profile.
Crab-like. And every time I see him hanging on to the back of the lead group in the mountains, or every time I've seen him this week, I've thought he's there purely to make Chris Froome's pedalling action look a little bit less ugly.
I quite like him though, Bauke Mollema. I think I don't know, I've got a soft spot for him. I saw him, you know, it sounds disrespectful saying this. We were standing at the finish at Plata de Bay the other day, and it was chucking it down. There was hailstones. You were off with Lance Armstrong, Daniel, but Lionel and I were putting in the hard yards at the top of Plata de Bay, and it was horrible conditions, and riders were coming across the line, and they were in a right state. And he came into the press tent with his press officer, and you know, just to see a guy close up, and to see the state he's in, you know, we can say that he's riding Ala Zubeldia, but you get a real sense of what these guys are putting their bodies through.
He's riding very well, isn't he?
He's riding very well. We'll get an interview with him one day. Lionel feels really guilty now. I can tell he's gonna be agonising over that.
The thing was, I had a little chat with Haimar Zubeldia the other morning, and he was absolutely incredibly pleasant and completely, you know, he wasn't invisible.
There's no reason why a guy who finishes 7th shouldn't be unpleasant.
No, I'm not saying, but yeah, I did think, you know, it's been one of my sort of running jokes at Zubeldia, because you'd never see him. He would never attack.
Little does he know that it's you that invented that.
Too. We need to somehow superimpose Heimar Zubeldi onto that metaphysical sketch that Ciro drew for us earlier involving shadows and invisible men, and it could be quite a work of art.
It could. Right, on that note, let's finish up for tonight. A reminder that Kilometre Zero begins again on Monday. Special one coming up on Monday. Daniel, I think you can tell us a little bit about this one.
It's the Lance Armstrong one, isn't it? I went to see Lance Armstrong last week when he did his Le Tour one day ahead.
So this one will either get lots of listens or very few.
It could be the end of my career. You might not see me on Tuesday.
I think it's very balanced. We've got David Walsh in there as well, talking about Lance's return to France. So coming up, we've got other Kilometre Zeros coming out, though, Monday to Friday. A little sideways look at the tour, about 10 to 15 minutes long each episode. And they've been... Well, thank you very much for all your feedback. We passed a million listens on Friday, or Saturday, Friday?
Friday night.
We passed a million listens for all our podcasts this tour, so we're extremely grateful. That's really quite something.
Just on the Lance one, I would say, you know, we will get a bit of flack for this, for concentrating on, but you can't deny it's been a big story of the last few days. And I think putting it in a Kilometre Zero where everybody knows where it is, it's not in the middle of another episode, and people who are likely to be irritated by it at least will know where it is. And
don't listen.
It's dealt with in that episode.
Mass boycotts.
Well, you know, you give people information upon which to make their decisions. If they don't want to listen, then don't listen. But if you do, and I'd urge you to, because it is very interesting, give it a play and then get annoyed about it.
Yeah, let us know. Okay, that's all for Valence. We'll pick up tomorrow in Gap. And
I think last night was the last opportunity for Cassolet, for Lionel, wasn't it?
And not had any Cassolet.
He spurned that opportunity.
Been terrible, terrible.
Cassolet for Lionel has been like stage wins for Peter Sagan in this tour. So near and yet so far. Anyway, let's leave it for tonight. Thank you very much, Lionel.
You don't reckon we'll get one in Valence? No, too far, isn't it? Yeah. Good night, Richard.
Good night, Daniel.
Good night.
For the best analysis, discussions and interviews from the 2015 Tour de France, listen to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.